Chris Lula, Mr. Stevens.
May it please the court. This is a case that the sentencing occurred before the United States Supreme Court's decision in Rito. And the issue in this case is whether the district court properly exercised his authority and responsibility under 18 United States Code Section 3553A to impose a sentence which is sufficient but not greater than necessary to achieve the purposes of the sentencing statute.
Mr. Stevens, I had a question for you. If you look at the written memorandum that the district court prepared, it sounds about right. And then if you look at his oral comments at sentencing, I would agree with you that it's troublesome in light of Rita. But which of these two things should govern to the extent there's an inconsistency?
Well, I think the comments that were made in court should govern. Typically, the court's decision, as announced from the bench, is considered the ruling of the court. For instance, when a judgment and sentence differs from the sentence that's pronounced in the courtroom, it's the sentence that's pronounced in the courtroom that controls.
Well, that's true in terms of the bottom line, but I'm wondering about the rationale, since actually that's what we're really concerned about here. And the court seems to say all the right things here in the sentencing memorandum. So you would extend that rule to the rationale as well and say that the oral comments should control?
I would, but I don't think that's necessary. Although the sentencing memorandum was issued post-sentencing and the parties were not certainly given an opportunity to review and address the sentencing memorandum.
The memorandum before or after the sentencing?
The memorandum was filed after the sentencing occurred, or at the same time as the judgment was filed.
So he gave his oral comments first, and then the written statement was later?
That's correct. He gave his oral comments, then pronounced the sentence, and then post the sentencing hearing, filed a written sentencing memorandum.
Wouldn't the last thing tend to be the most authoritative? I mean, suppose he realized after he delivered his oral comments that he'd been rambling in a misleading way, so he prepares a written memo, and it's fine.
I think that kind of blindsides counsel and doesn't give counsel an opportunity to respond as you would have in the open courtroom.
Because what he says, I'm looking at page 6 of his written memorandum, he just says, well, he reviews the 3553A factors, which you've all seen, and he just says, after considering the record as a whole, and in particular defendant's age, criminal history, risk of recidivism, and need to protect society, the court finds that this recommendation is appropriate. Well, if I see language like that today, I mean, it looks fine to me. That's what I understand Rita allows people to do, as opposed to these ramblings where the judge is saying, he was talking about rebuttable presumptions at the district court level, and that's wrong. There's no question about that. We've said that's wrong. But I'm worried about, the question in my mind is whether we need to send this back when the judge seems to have said the right things in the memorandum.
Well, I'd ask you to take a look at page 4 of that sentencing memorandum, section 6, the defendant's sentence. Even in the memorandum, the sentencing judge states, the Seventh Circuit has held that any sentence that is properly calculated under the guidelines is entitled to a reasonable presumption of reasonableness.
Well, that's true at the appellate level.
Right.
That's
correct. And then he goes on to say, he says, see Booker, noting that the factors will guide appellate courts. Maybe there's some ambiguity. I mean, if you're right that there's some ambiguity even in the memorandum, then I think there's more to this appeal.
What is it that you think, if you had seen this memorandum, that you would have liked to rebut?
Well, certainly even the fact that the memorandum, in my view, says that there is a presumption of reasonableness.
No, forget that.
But the memorandum goes on to talk about discussing and reviewing the factors in 3553A. In fact, there was no such review of 3553A factors performed in open court. For instance...
Well, that's something you could have said in open court. What is it that you think... I don't see what you think he said that suggested he was thinking about something different from what he said in open court.
Well, I think, Judge Posner, that it's correct that what he says in the sentencing memorandum tracks in large part. Mm-hmm.
So what, all he did was correct this business about the level of the presumption. Also, you know what bothers me? The only thing I can imagine Judge Sharp doing on remand, if he really was confused about the presumption, is giving your client a discount because of the dog. I can't imagine that as fitting into 3553A.
I have to say, Judge, that the dog has nothing to do with this case. Mr. Lula...
Well, has nothing to do with the case?
Mr. Lula is...
What is it you would argue for a below... What would be your base for arguing that for a below... guideline sentence?
I think, Judge, the two things that I brought up at the time of sentencing were, number one, that although his criminal history was quite high, it was based on very minor by felony standards traffic offenses. And the judge's only response to that was, well, that's a problem under the guidelines. Again, indicating that the guidelines are a controlling issue in the case. He didn't address the nature and circumstances of those prior convictions. He didn't talk about whether overstated in the terms we would have used.
So then your bottom line is his statement at page 6, which talks about after considering the record as a whole, you're saying that's not enough. He needed more detail. He needed to explain more.
Of course, the case law
doesn't require that. You understand that.
I think this is sort of a pro forma sentencing memorandum which says the things that need to be said in a sentencing hearing. But the reality of the sentencing hearing itself is that Judge Sharp even referred to a recent decision of this court, Nitch, where he said there is a presumption of reasonableness and we're not free to depart. And he said, even if I wanted to in an appropriate case, I don't have the... that there are hard edges still, and I don't have that kind of authority. And I think the language that...
So you're saying that a boilerplate memorandum can't override the actual comments he makes.
Well, let's look at the comments that he has to say. He cites Nitch as re-enunciating the rebuttable presumption regarding following the guidelines. He says there are a lot of hard edges here still. They talk about the remaining rebuttable presumption. I don't think I'm at liberty yet to discard those cases as much as I might want to on some occasions. And then he says, I look at cases where sentences below the guidelines have been reversed, and those influence the court. And then he says, when I look at all that the below-guideline sentences are being reversed, that the Court of Appeals, in his mind at least, says that there is a rebuttable presumption, I think that's a clear indication.
What weight should we give to the fact that his lawyer talked about presumptively a reasonable sentence?
Judge
said even if it is presumptively a reasonable sentence, the court can and should look at the factors under 3553. And although he mentioned the criminal history in passing, he seems to have given a particular emphasis to the dog, which you say is irrelevant. So why is his real quarrel with his lawyer rather than with the judge?
I'm certainly not going to stand here and tell you that the dog is a reason for an hour or a sentence below the guidelines.
Yeah, his lawyer sentencing thought
it
was.
Mm-hmm. That was you,
Mr. Stevens. Yeah. Oh, that is you. Yes, mm-hmm.
That's correct.
Well, why do you harp on the dog then?
This was important to Mr. Lula, and this was something Mr. Lula wanted to make sure the judge understood, and he's entitled to his day in court. I'm not here to argue the dog or the propriety or impropriety of any actions of the law enforcement officer. What I'm here to argue is that what Judge Sharp said is there's a presumption that I have to follow, and I'm not free to disregard that presumption.
What were these felony convictions, by the way?
If you reference the pre-sentence report, all of the felony convictions were felony driving without a license, habitual offender type offenses. None of them were violent offenses, none of them were robberies, none of them were burglaries, none of them were assaults. They were all simply driving without a license, which had been elevated because of the number of them to felony offenses. The judge failed to address that.
How many?
I don't know the answer to that. I would have to refer to the pre-sentence report.
For some reason, I thought there were about 10 of them, but I can't remember where I saw that.
There certainly were a large number of them.
But they were all motor vehicle things. That's, so you think that the judge should have actually, since the criminal history was the point you raised, should have engaged in some discussion of that factor, even though they're not supposed to, they don't need to do every factor, but that one.
That's correct. But I go back to his statement that I don't think I'm at liberty yet to discard those cases as much as I might want to on some occasions. And I think that clearly indicates that the judge was under an erroneous assumption, since clarified by Rita, that there is no presumption at the district court level.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Stevens. Mr. Barrett?
May it please the court. A couple of points. First, as to Mr. Lula's criminal record, there were, I don't have the pre-sentence report here, there were, I think, about 10 driving violations. And in addition, he was granted the privilege of voluntary surrender, but his bond was revoked because he had another traffic violation while he was out on bond in this case.
He just really has a problem behind the wheel, but not like many of the criminal histories that you see.
Right, that's certainly true.
He's not out there selling drugs or robbing banks or otherwise.
Are all his traffic violations driving without a license?
I believe that all of his traffic violations are for being habitual traffic violator.
So none. Are there any for driving under the influence?
I don't recall there being any DUI cases in there.
Or reckless driving?
I think I'm pretty sure they were all for he was driving when he wasn't allowed to drive. As to the point
don't
about,
don't you think that warranted some further discussion? The fact that these were just traffic violations warranted further discussion from the court?
The court could have addressed it. I don't know that the court was required to address it. I mean, we have
a
situation.
When somebody brings up a 3553A factor, we've said the court should engage with that, even though you don't have to go down some long checklist. But simply to ignore evidence that's put in front of you doesn't seem right.
Well, the court did say that he considered the circumstances and nature of Mr. Lula's prior criminal history. He says that on page 5 of the sentencing transcript.
Right, but isn't that, I mean, what does that mean? I don't know what that means. I think you're a typical felon. I think you're atypical, but for some other reason I've decided to punish you. I mean, I don't get much out of that statement.
I mean, all I can say is that is what the court said. Certainly the court could have engaged in a longer colloquy about the nature of his criminal history, about the dog issue. The court chose not to do that. But the court did say it has reviewed the 3553A factors. It has considered the nature of his prior criminal history. So I think a reversal would essentially, the rule of a reversal in this case would be that a court has to specifically address the 3553A arguments
that
counsel
raises.
Well,
a point that has been actually raised before you do need to say something about, because how can we engage in appellate review of reasonableness of a sentence if the judge doesn't tell us a thing about what he's decided? I assume district judges follow the law, and so I assume they look at the 3553A factors. Just saying I looked at the 3553A factors doesn't do much.
I mean, I think it's the case that under, you know, some of the cases that we cite for what the reasonables in this standard of review is, that it is a light standard of review. And, I mean, I don't think this court has required that in the past. If the court wants to do that, I think it would also need to require the judge to say why he doesn't think the argument about the dog is sufficient.
No, I'm not sure about that. As you can say it's irrelevant, but I don't think you're right, as a matter of fact. I think our prior decisions have said, you know, if you have put something on the table, whether it's a psychologist report, it seems to me that was in one case, or other specific evidence pertinent to a particular factor, you need to say something about it.
Unless it's frivolous.
Yeah. Oh, sure.
It's so look, with regard to his criminal history, all his felonies jacked him up to a criminal history 5, which is very high. Mm-hmm. So wouldn't it be plausible for a judge to think, well, 5, you know, it's what you get ordinarily for a more serious type of misbehavior than just driving without a license.
Well, I think it's worth noting here, and the government pointed this out in the sentencing hearing, that Mr. Lula's criminal history points were actually, not only was it a Category 5, it was 1 point below Category 6, which is the highest.
Right.
And in spite of that fact, the court imposed a sentence at the low end of the level 5 criminal history range. So I think it's reasonable to say that, I mean...
So you basically don't see any difference between all of these traffic felony convictions and what we more routinely see, defendants with drug convictions, robbery convictions. In your mind, there's no difference.
Oh, I think there is a difference. And that
was not really addressed by the court. That's the point we're trying to make.
Right.
You're asking us what it would be a good rule. You know, would we say if we ruled against you, well, you have to address everything, but this is a 3553A factor that it has a measurable consequence. A measurable consequence versus, you know, I have my children are going to be without a mother or whatever. But this is measurable and tied to, and there was nothing more said. So, we could come up with a rule. The rule could be pretty clear. When it's measurable, it has a real impact on the sentence. The court has to address it, or at least in this circumstance,
right,
when it affects criminal history points.
I mean, I think it is worth noting, while the court did not specifically address the nature of his criminal history, the court did impose a sentence at the low end of the guidelines range,
and that's the difference. In his oral comments, he seems to have thought that he couldn't consider, couldn't go behind the criminal history, that it would somehow violate the guidelines, and he was bound by the guidelines.
I probably can't make much more of the oral comments than the court can just by reading the record. I think it is...
His written memo is pretty pro forma.
It is fairly pro forma, although he does say at the beginning that, you know, he used, you know, Mr. Stevens' problem is that... he doesn't have a chance to respond to the sentencing memorandum. What Judge Sharp says on page 2 of the transcript is, you know, I used to prepare these ahead of time and distribute them so counsel could see them, but the Court of Appeals criticized me for doing that, so now I've stopped doing that, and so I, you know, prepare them and file them afterwards. I can't tell you when he actually prepared that memorandum, whether he actually prepared it after the hearing, but it is the case that he certainly didn't file it until after the sentencing hearing.
Well, in light of that, then, since we don't know exactly when he prepared this thing, the idea that we would give more credence to the written document maybe shouldn't prevail in this case. All right. I don't have any comments. That's just a comment.
The court did say that on the, I think it's page 11 of its transcript, that he would embody his sentence and his comments in a written sentencing memorandum. So he addressed that he would be filing a memorandum. Here's the import of that memorandum.
Mm-hmm. The likelihood to me is that the memorandum was probably prepared. They're both dated March 15th. Mm-hmm. So the date at the end of the written memorandum is March 15th. The date on the transcript is March 15th. And there's nothing in the memorandum that incorporates a discussion of what went on during the oral proceeding.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the dog's not mentioned. I mean, there's no like clue that the oral proceeding contributed to the analysis. So, I mean, I don't know, but the fact is the dates are the same.
I don't know either, but you're correct. He doesn't address anything that happened at the hearing. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Barron. So, Stevens, time expired?
Yeah.